The idea of a career isn't what it used to be. You might have noticed that in fits and starts. That job you chase turns out to be a contract, and then another contract. You read stories on the gig economy or the number of millennials who still live with their parents. The new person at work is a temp. If you live downtown in a city like I do, you might notice an awful lot more posters featuring services like taxes, IT, dog walking, even legal stuff like wills offered by qualified people working freelance out of their homes. Then one Labor Day, you look up and a survey of 1,200 Canadian millennials finds that only 44% of them have found full-time employment, and a majority of them don't have pensions or benefits, and it hits home. Precarious work is now a fact of the modern labor market. So if you can't lock down a job because jobs no longer lock down, how do you plan for a financial future? And after that, what does not being able to plan for that future do to your mental health? And is there anything we can do to change it, or is this just the future of work? I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings, and this is The Big Story.
There's, you know, some really high-paying, high-end jobs, and then there's a bunch of quote-unquote low-skilled, low-wage jobs, and there's not a whole lot in between.
Sara Majdahedzadeh is the work and wealth reporter at the Toronto Star. She's covered this beat for a while, and it's not just millennials, is it, Sara?
It's actually funny because the story about the report on millennials and precarious employment came out over Labor Day weekend. I was away with my friends from high school at a cottage, and they're like, oh, you don't usually write that much specifically on millennials. And that's kind of true. I tend to focus more broadly on how the workplace is changing rather than focusing on a particular age group. And that's really because it's impacting people across the age spectrum. But there's definitely some, I think, unique features about how millennials find work and sort of what their transition from post-secondary or college or high school is like in the workplace.
What is a precarious worker?
That's a good question, because I feel like the term precarious employment means different things to different people. And
right.
Sometimes as a reporter who's like been writing about it for 4 years, I forget that. But the definition of a precarious job that I think most people sort of accept is a job where you don't have a permanent position, you don't have full-time hours necessarily, you don't have benefits, you don't have a pension. And a precarious job can be one or all of those things combined. So it's basically anything that is not what we sort of refer to as the standard employment relationship, which is a permanent full-time job.
Right. So, none of those things that you mentioned are those are the four things that I associate with the reason I have a job.
Yes. So, yeah, it's sort of, I guess, anything that deviates from like that standard conception of a job and leads to some form of insecurity in your life.
So when the latest study came out over Labor Day, how bad is it getting?
I mean, we've known for a while that insecure jobs are on the rise.
Right.
So the group that did this particular study on millennials, they're called PEPSO, in conjunction with McMaster University, have done quite a bit of research on precarious work in this region. So we know that in the GTA and Hamilton area, around half of all jobs now have some kind of job insecurity associated with them. And usually when you look at the employment figures that come out regularly, even when there's a growth in employment rates, a lot of the times that's fueled by the growth of, say, part-time jobs, which again is pointing to the rise of sort of more precarious forms of work.
Right.
So it's definitely here to stay. It's definitely a feature of our economy now.
What's driving it? Is it, because, I mean, the thing that we all hear about are the disruptors, right?
Yeah.
The Ubers and Lyfts and et cetera.
Yeah.
Is that at the bottom of it?
I think that's definitely part of it. It's technology. It's globalization. It's the fact that businesses aren't just competing domestically anymore. They're competing with businesses, you know, on the other side of the world. But I think that it's important not to overstate those as the driving factors. I think that in a lot of cases, these are decisions that we're making as business owners, as managers, and sort of as a society that, like, we're okay with this kind of employment and we're not going to legislate policies that will encourage the creation of good, solid jobs.
How did we get to that point? Because there was a lot of talk over Labor Day about just how much the labor movement has given us.
Mm-hmm.
And all the things we're talking about today seem like that's in jeopardy.
Yeah. And I think it's sort of crept up on people as well. When you look at our employment laws in Ontario, they were really formulated at a time in the post-Second World War era when most people, or many people, did have a union. They were unionized employees. So they accessed their rights on the job through their union, not through employment legislation. But our employment legislation is super important because it sets like the basic standards that anyone can expect in the workplace, regardless if they're unionized or not. So as unionization rates fell, people sort of like slowly lost a lot of those entitlements and rights, and more people became reliant just on those basic employment laws to access their rights. And those employment laws were really flawed. They didn't keep up with how our workplace is changing. And so like even though we've actually recently gone through a bunch of reforms that did update our employment laws, you know, I think a lot of people are shocked to learn that if you're not unionized, you don't have the right to be protected from, say, unjust dismissal. Your employer doesn't need to give a reason to fire you because that's not included in our basic employment laws. So the way that we access our rights has really changed and our legislation has not really kept up.
Can it ever keep up with the way technology is driving change in the workforce?
I think it's hard. I think, you know, legislators are usually like a few steps behind. But I think certainly until recently, we were way more than a few steps behind. We were like decades behind. And now I think there's been a shift in the conversation and people are starting to talk about, you know, how do we keep up? Again, the last government did bring in a bunch of reforms that sort of tried to close the gap a little bit. And there were some major reforms brought in through that.
What kinds of stories do you hear when you talk to people who are in precarious employment? What does that mean on the ground?
I think the thing that's really jumped out for me is I think I expected precarious employment to often mean financial insecurity. A lot of these jobs are low-income jobs or it's just a regular income. You don't know when your next paycheck is going to come in and how much it's going to be.
Right, freelancers.
Yeah, exactly. And that, I think we all sort of, like, we get that about precarious
yep.
employment. But I think the thing that has really jumped out for me on this beat is kind of the social and emotional impact it has on people. Without fail, almost every, like, precarious worker, temp agency worker that I have spoken to, when I ask them what is really difficult for them about their job, yeah, it's the finances, but it's also feeling like a second-class citizen in your own workplace, feeling like you're not included. You know, things like, I remember one lady telling me that she worked at a workplace for years through a temp agency and the company would always have like a Christmas party for the employees, but none of the temp workers would be invited.
Hmm.
And she found that hurtful. She found it, I think, like emotionally difficult.
Well, so much of workplace culture is like being part of the team,
yeah,
right?
Totally.
You try to build a strong team and then all of a sudden there's like clearly bench players or...
Yeah, and I think, you know, another sort of subject area that I've covered on this beat is looking at the legacy of occupational disease, which stems from a time where people did work for 40 years in the same workplace. And I was chatting with a few of those folks last week and they were saying, you know, I really don't know how young people cope in this day and age. Like when I went to work, my work was my family. That's how we socialized. That's how we met our partners. And, you know, young people today might not even know the names of the people they work with. They might not even have any colleagues, you know, if they're working in the gig economy. And I think that is difficult. And I think that, you know, some of the research that we're seeing about precarious work and its impact on millennials shows that it makes it harder for them to get involved in their community life and to feel part of their social fabric. And I think that's going to have a real impact down the line that a lot of people haven't really clocked.
Right. And one of the reasons that I wanted to do this topic and talk to you, aside from the numbers that are clearly important, is we got an email from one of our listeners named Matt. I'm just going to read a little bit to you. I'm a university graduate living in Ottawa. I'm currently on my second casual contract with the federal government. That means I get to work for about 3.5 months and then I have to find something else. There was about a 2-month gap between contracts. Most of the people I know from university are also in this kind of work position, or they're opting to work for restaurants because it pays better than a lot of the entry-level admin jobs that might be available to them. So, I mean, if even the federal government is putting people in these positions, what does that say about like the nature of going to get a higher degree at university? Why are these folks doing it?
Yeah, I think that's a really important point because we're actually seeing the public sector driving a lot of the increase in precarious employment.
It used to be like, go get a government gig, right?
Exactly.
Like that was the most secure job you could get.
Exactly. And people still think that. And actually, I did a story a while back about the government's use of temp agencies. And yeah, they spend millions of dollars on hiring people through temp agencies. And speak to any young public service employee and you'll hear that they did years of contract to contract before getting a permanent job. And I think it's important to remember that those public service jobs, when they were more likely to, you know, be a permanent full-time job, were really part of what built the backbone of our like sort of middle class economy. And if you erode the quality of those jobs, what you get is what we see now, which is a society where there's real income polarization. So there's, you know, some really high paying, high end jobs, and then there's a bunch of low, quote unquote, low skilled, low wage jobs, and there's not a whole lot in between.
And what happens when you have people who should be working one kind of job turning to the other one? Because, you know, these are graduates from programs that expect jobs in the federal government, and they're choosing to go to the restaurant industry, which presumably keeps people who should be in the restaurant industry from getting those jobs.
Yeah. Well, one thing I think is that a lot of if you're, you know, you've spent a lot of money on your education, you're picking up that restaurant job with, you know, $27,000 of student debt.
Right.
And can you pay that off on a minimum wage? Like, that's going to be really tough. And we see millennials, what this report shows is that millennials are pushing back those big life decisions further and further because they can't or to, you know, start a family or buy a home or buy a car or whatever. And yeah, it increases competition amongst, you know, again, I say quote unquote low skilled jobs because I think our conception of them is kind of flawed. But yeah, it increases competition for them. And that makes it really difficult for people who don't have many other options.
Right. Millennials is kind of funny because I feel like, and maybe this is just me, but I feel like it's a lot of people that I talk to around this office and in the media. When we talk about millennials, we kind of have this image of like, you know, this early 20s person, maybe just getting out of school, maybe living with their parents while they get their feet under them. But millennials are old now.
Yeah, millennials are coming up for 35.
Like, that's crazy. Yeah. I mean, but that's the age, like 35. You talked about pushing life decisions further down, right? 35 is an age, I think, if you ask people when they were 18, you know, where do you expect to be by 35? You would say married, kids, house, career.
Yeah, that's definitely changing. I think there's so many misconceptions about what a millennial is. I think, first of all, there's a misunderstanding about what the age bracket is, but I mean, I think we've probably all experienced the sort of stereotype of the millennial being lazy and entitled and, you know, they don't know how good they have it and when I was your age, et cetera, et cetera.
And you can't afford a home because you spent your money on avocado toast as opposed to you know, the real estate restaurant.
Yes, and the real estate market's crazy and, you know. And I actually had a few of those emails after I wrote that story about the precarious work amongst millennials from folks who took great exception to the facts of what life is actually like for a millennial.
Did you get any emails from millennials?
Yeah. I mean, I regularly get emails from young people who are really living that lifestyle and sort of struggling to establish themselves. But the one thing I would say, again, is that precarious work really impacts people across the age spectrum. So whenever people sort of write these angry emails about, you know, millennials being entitled, I do try and like explain that this is something that affects all of us and singling out a particular group for, you know, whatever qualities they believe have led them to have these difficulties is really counterproductive because we're talking about policy decisions and business decisions and social decisions that impact everyone.
What kind of role or responsibility do employers have? Because I'm sure, and you can tell me, there's a lot of sleazy stories out there about getting kind of just enough part-time hours to not be a full-time worker, et cetera, et cetera. What kind of stuff do you hear is being done now?
That one's a common one. I mean, using temp agencies or going contract to contract.
But there's no legislation about like how many contracts you can do in a row.
No, and that was one of the things that many worker advocates wanted in the last round of reforms, that you can't have people as perma-temps. The government didn't go in that direction, but they did institute new laws that sort of reduced the financial incentives to be hiring people on these temporary contracts or through temp agencies. So one of them, for example, is mandating equal pay for equal work, regardless of employment status. So that's a big one.
How sleazy can they get?
Oh, really sleazy. Last year, I worked at a factory undercover as a temp agency worker. And, you know, when I wrote that story, I had a lot of people write to me and say they were shocked to hear about these working conditions where everyone is hired through a temp agency. You know, three people had died in that factory. You know, you were being shouted at all day. Sometimes you wouldn't be allowed to go to the bathroom even. I mean, it was a very tough work environment. I mean, that is one factory, but that is not necessarily the exception. A lot of places are operating like that. And again, a lot of the people who I worked with were young people. They were my age. They were, you know, first generation Canadians who grew up here and just couldn't find another job. They weren't some, like, I don't know what people think about people working in these environments, but they're you and I mean, and that's why I really push back against this idea of like low skilled work. It's work that we all could be doing. It's just a question of how those workers are treated. I mean, there are employers who have realized that this isn't necessarily the best model, and that if you invest in your employees, you know, you get a good return out of that.
What about Canada-wide? Because it's certainly, this is not an Ontario problem.
No, this is happening everywhere. I think Ontario is in some ways the epicenter for things like temp agency work. I think part of that, I mean, we're obviously the biggest province.
Yep. But
I think we're sort of a testing ground for a lot of this stuff. The federal government, interestingly, they regulate certain sectors. Like most of us, we're governed by provincial labor laws, but the federal government does have purview over some sectors like banking or transit and that kind of thing. And they're now starting to talk about introducing reforms to update the federal labor code. So like at lots of different levels, I think this conversation is starting to happen. In BC, the provincial government, you know, is talking about reforms. In Alberta, we see the $15 minimum wage. So it's definitely happening everywhere.
Thanks very much, Sarah.
Thank you.
Sarah Mojtahedzadeh, work and wealth reporter at the Toronto Star. That was The Big Story. For more from us, visit us at thebigstorypodcast.ca. You can find all of our episodes there, and you can also contact us like Matt did, and we can always use your story ideas. You can also hit us up on social media, Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram, at Big Story Podcast. And of course, you can find us on basically any podcast app you prefer to use, and you can subscribe for free. Please rate us, leave us a review, let us know how we're doing. I'm Jordan Heath-Rawlings. Thanks for listening. We'll be back on Monday.